everybody. Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, it's Jason Sagabiel, and he is the owner of Sage Music in Long Island City. That's a place where you can go get lessons. It's a great place to get lessons. You know where else you can get lessons? The New York City Guitar School, and they are sponsoring the show. And that's sort of a rough one. Like, which direction do we go in? Do you go to Sage Music? Because Jason is on the show to get your lessons. Well, you know, if you want to go to Long Island City, I think they got some other locations. You can look it up. And you know, I'm with both. Just you take your pick. Pick your poison. Where are you going to go get lessons? The New York City Guitar School or Sage Music in Long Island City? Jason was also a Marine sniper, and has an excellent story about how, you know, his journey through the ranks. And, you know, over in the Middle East, in the war, you know, ended up leading to him coming back and being the musician who he is. The show is also sponsored by SavageClassical.com, S-A-V-A-G-E, Classical.com. Go there, get the guitar of your dreams, the accessories you need. That's right there in Bayshore, New York, or you can visit them online, SavageClassical.com. Also, AudibleTrial.com/insider for a 30-day free trial. And a free audiobook download on us here. Don't forget to go to getbarkbox.com. Jesus, I feel like a NASCAR. Getbarkbox. I'm just like covered in advertisement. Getbarkbox.com/insider. That's G-E-T. Getbarkbox.com/insider. And I forget what their deal is, but they'll hook you up with something too. You'll be helping out the show. And if you want to just, you know, forget about all these people and just donate to the show, it's my birthday, for crying out loud. Just give me a little birthday present. Buy me a birthday drink. Why not? It's go to Brett Williams Music. That's B-R-E-T, williamsmusic.com. And for my 40th birthday, that's right, tonight I will be celebrating my 40th birthday. It's February 4th. This is my party is tonight. I'm actually going to go there. I'm going to leave right after I record this intro. So I don't know. I thought I'd touch base with you guys then, right? Like, this is kind of an exciting time. But if you want to get me a birthday present, I would be very touched. It's my 40th birthday. I've got a lot of listeners. I don't know if you guys are still listening. I might have really screwed up. I haven't released anything in a month. And that's the way it goes because I am a public school teacher right now. I teach for 12 hours a day. It's just the way it's going to go. I will get these out when I can. And I'll be back with this too. I think in the summer, we're going to pick up some steam again, you know? So I think after a couple of years, it's okay for me to take a break. I expect you guys to still, you know, stick with it, right? Still a fun show. But to do that, Brett Williams Music, Brett with one T, B-R-E-T, williamsmusic.com. And if you go to any of the subpages, if you click on podcast, if you click on media or anything, if you do anything like that, on the right there, it says, how am I going to eat? And then it gives you instructions about how to donate through PayPal. So let's have a little bit of love for the old big diaper here and go ahead and send me a birthday present. I could use it. I moved into a new apartment with my girlfriend. And it's super fun. We just finished moving in, yesterday, and the place is not fully decorated, but whatever we had before, we're kind of combining things and what a weekend, right? I mean, this is all happening. This is insane. So we have had to sit here and we've had to reconcile everybody else's things. We're two different people. We're not completely different, but I mean, you know, there's a dog pillow here and it's looking right at me. Now I wouldn't have gotten a dog pillow, but now I've become kind of attached to the dog pillow. My favorite thing that happened was the teddy bear. The stuffed animals had been reintroduced into my life. I hope she's okay with me talking about this, but basically, you know, puppies and teddy bears I forgot about them. Well, it turns out that they are the adornments of many households with ladies in them. So I kind of had this, you know, sort of a minimalist aesthetic going on, And now, you know, we're kind of moving things around. I mean, she has a lot of respect for me and the way that, like, I kind of decorate my house, which is sort of sparse. But yet, you know, there are touches of things. I like to put things on the wall. And you know, she gave up a lot of stuff to move here because there's not as much space and there's two people. But so we did all that. It's just been an insane week of doing that, of having to, the thing about moving is that you have to talk about everything you do. So it's two people and I'm talking to you guys like you don't know, you've never done this, but if you haven't done it for a while, it's pretty interesting. And I haven't had a new girlfriend for a while that I've moved in with. I mean, that hasn't happened in 15 years. So I'm moving in with this girl, this very special girl. But basically, you know, we both are people with opinions. We both are people who care about our environment and care about the things that we own and care about the space that we live in. And we have had to pretty much look at every single blanket, pillow, coffee table, painting, TV, fork, spoon, cleaning supply, and make decisions together about where they're supposed to go. And that's a thing. You know, that's a real issue when you think about it. It could, with a lesser couple, lead to, at any, there's been so many opportunities for massive fights to break out that it's a pleasure to report that we are strong, and I think that we've got something real here. Because there's a lot of other people out there that I think I would have killed. And I hope she takes that with a grain of salt, with an understanding that everything I say is with love and with an admiration for the fact that we've done this together. For people without money to move into this is kind of a nice apartment in New York is, I mean, it's nice by my standards. I mean, I had a roommate and a tiny bedroom before. It's a basement apartment, but it gets enough light actually. Plenty of opportunities to, you know, beat the shit out of each other. We didn't. Everybody's still walking. She's actually right now. She is, oh no, did I break something? No, I'm just looking around seeing what I broke. Only thing was, I got to get a desk again. I'm doing this at a coffee table. I can't do this at a coffee table. But it's nice. We're both musicians. So, you know, she was practicing today and I kind of felt I was playing a video game. And I was like, I can't like play a video game while she practices. So I went in the other room and I practiced for the first time in a long time for a couple of hours. Played a little Tango in Sky there, you know, getting my fingers back into it. And it felt good. So I think this is a good match. This feels good. Is it okay for me to talk about this stuff? I already talked about all the sponsors. The kids are hilarious in the Bronx. There's just been 1,000 things that have happened. I'm telling you, and this episode has not come out for so long. I'm getting these done when I can. A lot of people I really love are like, well, why don't you just practice to do the podcast, you know, like at night or on the way? I'm like, dude, I'm working literally from 7:30 in the morning. I'm getting home at 8:30 at night. That's 4 days a week. And then, you know, what do? I work on Friday, maybe teach a couple of kids in the Upper East Side. I'm home at 5. And at that point, dude, give me a break. I just want to go hang. I just want to crash. Or hang out with a friend, you know, and not to mention, I mean, I'm a pretty good friend. So like, I'm going to go meet somebody for their birthday. I'm having a birthday party tonight. You know, I mean, I'm going to do stuff. I'm not just going to sit there and get out of work after working and teaching kids, which is exhausting. And then worry about the podcast is important to me, but for crying out loud, I also need some time off. There's a vacation coming up very soon in the winter break, which I always was like, oh, good. It's going to be time to practice. Now I'm like, I don't want to practice. I want to get out of town. I understand now the 9-to-5-er. It's great. It's been, what a perspective. But I do need to, I need to play guitar again, because I played today. It felt incredible. It felt really good. And, yeah. So the kids are a lot of fun. One of the person that I work with actually got injured. It's a slightly horrifying story, but she's pregnant, and slightly, it is horrifying. The kids are bananas, you know, and this kid got real upset and hit the whiteboard, which flipped around and hit my, this is really horrible. Hit my friend who I teach with in the stomach. And she had to go to the hospital. Turns out everything's totally okay. There were no injuries done. Everybody's okay. And what a terrifying time that was. But as a result, and I don't mean to minimize the situation at all. I'm moving on because it was a very upsetting situation. I'm sure you understand. It was very scary. I taught, and I was teaching all her classes for a week, and it was it's another reason. I mean, I was actually teaching. I wasn't developing lesson plans. I was just doing it off the cuff there, you know, going rogue. And it turned out I was teaching piano, having not know how to play piano myself. I mean, I took some class piano, so I know the finger numbers and blah, 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 kind of. I keep on calling finger one my index finger because I'm a guitarist, but finger one is your thumb, folks. So I'm sitting there teaching. This is a fun story. I'll end on this and then we'll get on with the interview. But and then happy 40th to me, right? February 5th, 1977. Mom, if you're listening, can you believe it? I'm 40. Unbelievable, right? That's something. When are they going to stop calling me a young man, though? Someone was talking about JFK and how he was 45 or something. And they're like, oh, he's just a kid. When he was president, I guess he was the youngest president ever. I'm like, it feels to me like I'm not a young man anymore, but I am. I think I'm just a man now, just plain old man. Anyway, so I'm sitting there, I'm teaching the kids how to play piano. I'm getting up there, and the other teacher, because there's two teachers at the school, the other teacher's helping me out a little bit. He's the teacher assistant for Becca's class. Nobody can just teach back-to-back classes. It's just like, it's insane. Especially at this school. It's just bananas. So he's watching me, and all right, kids, you know, and they're talking, they're ignoring me. I hold up my thumbs and I go, okay, should everybody show me finger one? And a smattering of them do, I see four kids out of 30 holding up their finger ones. And I'm like, come on, everybody, finger one. I'm dancing, I'm yelling, I'm screaming, I'm doing everything I can to get them to show me the finger one. And I all right, everybody, now, give me finger two. So I hold up my index fingers in both hands. This is for the piano, remember. So holding up my fingers in both hands. I mean, finger two, kids. It gets a little bit quieter. There's more of them, They're starting to figure out what's going on here. They're starting to smell blood, right? Because I got the finger ones with the thumbs, and then they see me hold up finger two, and they know what's next. Remember, finger two is the index. So they think they can see it. They're like, wait a second, is this guy going to let us? So I go, all right, everybody, because they think they're going to be able to hold up the middle finger, right? And the way a lot of teachers do it is they hold up, the fingers. It's hard to explain, but they'll hold up the thumbs, and then they'll add to that the index fingers. So that's finger one and two. And then they'll add to that the finger three, which is your middle finger. So at that point, you're holding up your thumb, index, and middle fingers in both hands. You following me? That's the way to teach it without having, people use their middle finger, which is inappropriate. But I don't care about what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. I want these kids to, well, I do to a degree, but I want these kids to know, what they're, I want them to know. So I'm holding up one finger at a time, and the other teacher's like, don't do it, don't do it. I'm like, all right, everybody, I want you to look me right in the eye. And the room gets real silent. And this happened for all five classes. Look me right in the eye. The kids are sitting there, sixth and seventh graders. They're looking at me. It's like, I want you to look me right in the eye, and I want you to hold up a big, fat finger five. And I hold up my pinkies and they're like, oh, Jesus, oh, no. And I'm just like, a finger five. They can't, you know, they don't know what to do. They're starting to go crazy, you know, and it's just an energy in the room. And there's people screaming at the top of their lungs. And then, you know, and I go, finger four, you know, so finger five is your pinky. Finger four is your ring finger. We still haven't gotten to finger three. And they're like, finger four. And they're like, finger one. You know, I'm just like destroying them, you know, and they're just like, you know, there's people smacking the tables. And then I just go, I go, all right, kids. I want you to do this. I want you to hold up your fists and I want you to look at me. It's completely silent at this point. Hold up your fists and I want you to show Mr. Brett. So one time you're going to be able to do this. Show Mr. Brett your finger three. You know, they flip me the bird. And the happiness that flooded the room and the hearts of those children cannot be understated. They went absolutely bananas. There were boys practically in tears, just holding up their fingers at me. Just like, oh my God, fuck, you know, fuck you, Mr. Brett, just holding up that finger and flipping me off. And Mr. the other teacher, I'll just go ahead and say it. Mr. Stein, the best guy on earth, is just sitting there going, what are you doing? You know, and and I tell you, these kids are never going to forget the finger names because they know finger one's the thumb and then they know the finger three and then they can work their way around there. But these kids are never going to forget the finger numbers for the piano, are they? So I would do stuff like that. You know, sing to them, dance for them, just do whatever. Do whatever it takes. They like me. I get along with the kids. Anyway, I just love that. I love the kid who's just sitting there. I don't want to say his name, but he's got these little white glasses and he's just sitting there. He's literally almost in tears. You know, his kid's like just jumping up and down. I mean, you can't get enough of it. I said to the kids, I said, you know, if I was allowed to take pictures of you, I would take a big picture of this and this would be my Christmas card because the view of having 30 little hands, we'll take it times two, 60 little hands, just flipping you off. It's just, there's nothing like it. It's just like a field of poppies. All right, so let's get on with the show. Here's my buddy. Make sure you donate to me. It's my birthday, for Christ. Just please donate to me. All right? And I'm sorry for using the Lord's name in vain. I'm trying not to. I'm trying to get that out of my vocabulary. All right, let's get on with Jason.
I think it's Sage Beal, and that's actually how I got the nickname of Sage. Because no one could ever say the name correctly.
Oh, yeah, Sage Music is your company here.
Yeah, that's correct.
Is that correct? Yeah. You would say, so this is a beautiful building. It's my first time at this complex. Right now we're in Long Island City.
Yes.
On 23rd Street.
23rd Street.
4402 23rd Street.
That's the address.
There is a secret theater next to us.
Yeah, I think it's the secret theater.
Well, I don't even know if we should be talking about it.
Well, it's pretty well hidden behind the loading dock.
Right.
It's funny.
It's kind of well hidden, except for the giant red signs that are all over the street.
You know, somehow people managed to miss it, you know. So the building has the address in the loading dock.
Yeah.
Right in front of the secret theater. So we have students coming here to the school who see the address in the loading dock, and they come into the loading dock. But they have this really nice entrance.
I went into the loading shop. Dock.
Did you?
I spent about 5 minutes in the loading dock talking to a worker.
Okay.
And he told me to finally enter through the front, which is what a normal person would do.
Well, yeah, you do look normal.
Thank you. I look normal.
Yes.
As far as going through, I had passed the loading dock, went to the secret theater, was incredibly curious, but held off on checking it out. I think I'm going to check it out afterwards. Well,
you should.
The theater. We shouldn't play there, right?
Well, I've done some concerts there, actually.
You have?
Yeah.
Okay, my only thing is, I used to do this. I used to play in places like that, but, you know, rent them out or whatever.
Sure.
But it is all black, and there's absolutely no acoustic value whatsoever, right?
Well, you can hear. I mean, you can hear things. So I would say there's some acoustic value.
Yeah.
No, but it's hard for, like, I mean, especially, like, guitar would be really difficult in that space just because the guitar is not a loud
solo
projecting
guitar
instrument,
would suck. Yeah. But it's, I mean, as far as just like, maybe, I don't know. I like these places, but I feel like also people, the audience, the guitar audience, It has a thing against places like that. When they hear that it's not going to be at the Baruch, or it's not going to be at, you know, an established, you know, acoustic venue, they shy away from it. I think our audience is kind of into the idea of a combined aspect of a beautiful guitar and a beautiful space.
I mean, the beautiful space certainly makes the the guitar sound much more alive,
yeah.
You know, and I think that's why we hear so many recordings of guitar that are so covered in reverb, just because the guitar is inherently so, you know, sticky. Is that the word?
Yeah.
So I think the
sticky.
Space. Yeah.
I don't know if that's the word, but I like that. I don't know quite what you mean. Explain to me what you mean by sticky.
I guess when I mean sticky, it's like, you know, when I think staccato actually means sticky.
Oh, okay.
You know, and so like the notes are inherently just disconnected on the guitar,
right.
So the big cavernous spaces kind of really help cover those gaps,
yeah.
In a way that I think just makes it easier to play the guitar.
Yeah, easier to play the guitar.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's exactly. I think for us, it's easier.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you don't feel as exposed or naily or whatever.
Right.
Jason, where do you? You said you lived in Long Island. You live on the border of Astoria in Long Island City.
That's correct.
How do you like Long Island City? Is just beautiful.
Oh, I love this neighborhood. I've been here almost as long as I've been in New York City. One of the things I love about the neighborhood is there's just so many artists and musicians and people who've been here for such a long time.
Right.
And in fact, actually, one of the people I commissioned for the guitar orchestra, I met him walking down the street. He was just walking down the street holding a what are they? The old Passantino sketchbooks, the music books.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the old staff paper.
So you saw him walking around
and he just had
music?
He just had a Passantino book with him. And I was like, hey, are you a musician? And he's, oh, yeah. And we started to talk, and he was just very, very friendly.
Uh-huh.
And invited me to his studio. He asked, he wanted to know all about me, what I'm doing. And he wasn't, you know, he wasn't egotistical.
He wasn't closed off.
He was just very open and very friendly. We got to talking. And after I'd known this guy for about 3 or 4 months.
That's very brave of you to go up to somebody just because they have a Passantino notebook.
Maybe.
Is it Passantino? Did I say that?
Passantino? Yeah, I think so.
Passantino.
Passantino, yes.
But, you know, that's great. Really, I don't think I would have been like, oh, there's another musician.
Yeah. You know? do they scare you? Is that
I think they do a little. I mean, they don't now, but I think back in the day, me and my friend Giacomo used to make a joke. When we see another guitar walking down the street, be like, all right, get him.
And who was your friend's name?
Giacomo Levita.
Is this Giacomo of Giacomo's Restaurant?
No.
That
sounds like I like him better.
Okay, well, we can talk about Giacomo's Restaurant later. But
okay.
Back to
you know
this
what
guy.
I'm saying?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You went up to this guy and talked to him.
Yeah, so I started talking to him. And he was just very friendly, very approachable, very just interested in what I had to do. And after knowing him for some time, it turns out he was the guitarist and keyboard player for the B-52s for 20 years.
Holy shit, I love the B-52s.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, I think they're great, you know.
Oh, my God.
You know, and he was involved in writing Rock Lobster and Love Shack and all this stuff. And,
what?
Yeah, you know.
The keyboardist?
Just, yeah. Yeah, he played keys and guitar.
After the guitarist died, the kid died.
I don't know what the whole story is, but
Well, I guess one of the original guitarist died of AIDS.
Okay.
And it was the brother of Cindy Wilson, who's the blonde.
Mm-hmm.
God, okay, this is crazy. Yeah.
So he
was on Love Shack then, this guy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so anyway, I mean, met this guy, and he was just great, you know. Pat Irwin is his name, and we ended up commissioning him for the guitar orchestra.
Commissioning him to write something.
That's right.
And how, I mean, how is, I haven't seen it because I'm a bad, bad guitar, New York City guitar.
We'll get you tickets. Don't worry.
Yeah, I know, but I also want to, I should just pay into the system once in a while. All right, go ahead.
actually, we're going to be performing it again in May.
Oh my God, I'm going.
Yeah.
I'm going. Is he going to be there?
Is he
the guy who's like on the cover of the album?
No, I don't think he's on the cover of the album.
He's like just like a studio guy.
No, he was on stage with him all the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
What's his name again?
Pat Irwin.
Now he's like not a classical guitarist, but he's a composer.
He's a composer. He's a guitarist. He's done music for HBO. I think he did the music in the sound for Nurse Jackie. He did. He worked on SpongeBob. And yeah.
You met a gem.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you see somebody with a Passantino notebook,
you got to say hi. But this is all over this neighborhood, you know. There's just people like this walking around. There's no pretension.
No pretension. That's the difference between what's going on my side of the bridge.
Yeah, I wonder, this is why I love this side of the bridge, is, you
right.
know.
Now we're talking about the
God, what's it called again?
Pulaski.
The Pulaski Bridge is what separates Brooklyn from Queens,
right,
for those of you who don't know. Now, Brooklyn, of course, is sort of the, you know, it's new hip. Bohemia.
Yeah, it's hip. It's cool.
Hipsters everywhere. Super cool. But, you know, you can open a door for somebody. They're not necessarily going to smile and say thank you. Whereas up here, it's way more down to earth.
Yeah, I feel like there's no hype about what people do up here. It's like there's working musicians and working artists. They treat it like a 9-to-5 job. They probably spend more time doing their work than talking about their work.
Right.
You know, and it's a very professional atmosphere, and that's one of the great things about this neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a great neighborhood. And you've been here for how long?
I've been here since 2000 and let's see, I came to New York in 2004 after the war, and then I guess I was here in 2006.
Yeah.
2006 is when I started working here at the community college.
After the war, 2004, you came.
I came to New York in 2004.
And this is, okay, so this kind of gets to the heart of the thing because, you know, Peter Argondita,
yes,
was on the show last time. This is actually the first show. I've never taken a break this long. And so he was talking about you, and he said one of the interesting things was, yeah, you're a soldier, right? Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say soldier. I was in the Marine Corps.
You were in the Marine Corps.
That's correct.
You were a Marine.
That's right.
And you got out in 2004. How long were you? I mean, tell me. Okay, so you're a Marine. And yeah. Now you're a classical guitar studio. You've got your own studio here,
yes,
in Long Island City.
So, I mean, long story short is I tried to join the Army out of high school. And I had bursitis, and the Army recruiter didn't want to see me.
What's bursitis?
It's just like swelling, like fluid on the knee.
Sure, I think I've got that everywhere.
Yeah, I think I have it now too, everywhere.
Big toe, yeah. Yeah.
Elbow, thumb joint, everywhere, right?
yeah.
And so since the recruiter just kind of brushed me off, I ended up going to college for music. I had a full scholarship.
What were you studying then? Guitar?
I had a double major between guitar and composition.
Oh, perfect.
And yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I think my junior year, my little sister joined the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And I think when your little sister joins the Marine Corps, you don't really have a choice, do you?
Yeah. I can't let this happen.
Right.
I have to.
So,
I have to get involved.
Yeah. So I ended up in the Marines.
Yeah.
I just joined the reserves because I'd already started college. Ended up in the infantry in the Marine Corps, and that was my first year. Then I guess some guys took notice, and I got recruited into the snipers, and so I served as a scout sniper.
What?
In the Marine Corps in the Iraq War in 2003.
Like the guy in the movie.
Yeah.
You're talking
about Bradley Cooper, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got a funny story.
You got
about
a Bradley Cooper sort of thing going on too, right?
Well, I've got this. I mean, it didn't happen, but it almost happened. So okay. Bradley Cooper plays the sniper in the movie,
right? What's it called? American Sniper.
American Sniper,
right?
No. And
great title.
Yeah, and actually, one of the guys that I know from that community actually coached him on kind of what to do for the movie, and then it kind of came back around. So I ended up getting
because there can't be that many snipers.
No, it's a pretty small community,
right? Yeah. Under 100 people.
I think of the entire Marine Corps, there's about 12 guys per battalion, and we only have like 12 battalions total. So we're looking like 145, 150.
How many people are in each battalion?
Battalions usually about 1,000 folks.
1,000. Okay, so a battalion is like, and then a unit is, what's a unit? You're a unit.
No, I would be one troop.
Okay, you're one.
So, say it works like a system of three. So, you've got three team members plus a team leader makes a team. Three teams makes a squad. Three squads makes a platoon. Three platoons makes a company. Three companies makes a battalion. Three battalions makes a regiment. Three regiments makes a division. Three divisions makes a corps, and that's why it's the Marine Corps.
Okay, corps of our military might.
Right, and then if you want to say, yeah, and then
well,
so,
one part, but one fourth of the situation.
Right, and so then you go up from corps, and that's an army.
Right. And if you count Coast Guards, do you have any Coast Guard friends?
No, I don't.
Where are they? What are they doing?
Those guys are actually pretty busy.
They have to be really busy these
days. They are really busy, yes.
I mean, they're like responsible for everything that's gone right.
Yeah, no, one of the things I say is if you get involved in the military and you want to do stuff, Coast Guard.
Yeah, right.
You know, whether it's wartime or not, those guys are busy with drug wars and people coming on ships trying to immigrate. And they're constantly busy.
Constantly on it. I mean, I can't believe you were a sniper. I mean, nobody's a sniper. I never met a sniper before in my entire life.
Well, about 20 minutes ago you did.
What on earth? So with the sniping thing, there's two people. Right, there's a sniper and there's a dude who does like the
spotter.
The
spotter.
Were you a sniper or a spotter?
Well, we trade
duties.
Do you
want to talk about this?
No, we can talk about it. Okay. So, see, so, yeah, no, typically we trade duties. You know, yeah. Because you get tired of doing one thing, so you keep switching. And, you know, during the war, we actually operated in four-man teams just because it was, it's not like the jungle or the forest where you can hide. The desert's pretty open and flat.
Right.
So you kind of need a few more people just to be a little more... a little more safe.
I love what he's doing. Dog, Bijou, the dog, a beautiful dog, is playing with a very hard toy, and I think he should be allowed to. We shouldn't. It's his Saturday, too.
Yeah, okay. All right.
I mean, yeah, it was pretty noisy. Yeah, maybe we'll find something squishy. But how about I pet you, Bijou? Will that keep you busy?
Oh,
as far as the...
that'll keep you busy.
That's
absolutely.
Good. She's a good dog. And then, you know, as far as that's concerned, so I can understand how the spotting and the, cause I mean, it's gotta be exhausted. The spotter is just telling the guy like a little to the left and the guy's just concentrating on like the micromanagement of his breathing and making sure everything goes off right.
Sure.
And
sure,
were you in combat?
Sure. I did a few things.
Jeez, man. Okay. And you're okay.
Yeah, mostly. I had a rough time. I mean, this is actually how my school was formed in the end, was that in the war,
right.
I got the first injury I had is I got hit in the face with a brick, and it ended up fracturing my skull.
Like just a kind of a protester sort of...
Yeah, my team had been sent
into
Overwatch.
That's not an insurgent. That's just like a... It is.
I mean, the situation was kind of... It's kind of been misrepresented in the media, I think, what's happened. But there are a lot of these local warlords. And one of the things they would do is they would break into people's homes and steal their propane tanks and then sell them back to the people in the market. Because there's no trees. You can't go chop down a tree and cook your food. You have to have the propane. So they would break into people's homes, steal their stuff, and sell it back to them. So we just broken up this group. I guess they were a little bit angry. And my team was sent to do an Overwatch mission. Some Marines were doing a checkpoint on the highway, and our job was to stay off at a distance and provide covering fire for them in case, you know, something went down at the checkpoint. And my team got compromised, and, you know, the four of us got surrounded by around 800 folks. And in that, you know, in that situation is where I got hit with the brick in the face.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. That sounds just like, I mean, you know, for idiots like me, that's just like out of a movie. But for you, this is like, I mean, it was the most terrifying thing in the world. Being surrounded by 800 people. I mean, and you're by yourselves.
I mean, there's certainly a sense of excitement about it. Right. You know, I don't want to say terrified. Yeah. Cause I don't feel like I was terrified at that moment. It's usually, when we get out of the field and we get back to base and then I have a moment to think, then it's like, shit.
Oh my God, what just happened?
Right.
Right.
You know, so I think in the moment it's not quite as terrifying. Even though I do remember the first time that we ended up taking fire, my team got inserted and, they had told us that if something goes wrong, I'm sorry, because the closest help is like 2 hours away.
Right.
And so we had been inserted and, we'd cleared this building, and when we cleared the building, I went up to the second floor with this other guy, and the building was bombed out. The roof was missing, and he tripped on something on the floor, and his foot, you know, slams against the floor. But since the roof was missing, it was like a bell turned upside down, so it was like you. It just reverberated everywhere. And as soon as that happened, we ended up taking fire, and. And we knew that there was no help in this situation. We were in Iranian-controlled territory in Iraq, basically hunting down this terror group called Skiri at the time.
Right.
And I remember the fire came in, and my team leader was very smart.
Are these Iranians or Iraqis?
These are Iraqis, but they were funded by the Iranians.
Right.
So he, I'm raising my rifle to shoot back, and he pushes my rifle down, and he says, "Hey." You know, he was smart. He said, you know, none of those rounds, well, not all of the rounds are hitting the building.
Right.
Some of the rounds are hitting the other building. Some of the rounds are going this way. And then it clicked. I was like, all right. I remember in my advanced infantry school that, you know, they always talk about recon by fire. If you know where the enemy is, shoot. When they shoot back, there they are. And so,
right.
And so we didn't shoot back. So we took fire for a while and just stay concealed and ended up making out of the situation okay, just because we didn't reveal our position. But that was the first time.
Which is the opposite of what they do in the movies.
Right.
They hold their gun above a brick and just like shoot randomly.
Yeah. But that was the first time I realized that fear had a smell.
Right.
Like I smelled fear. Yeah. Sometimes you hear this phrase, the smell of fear.
Yeah.
And I smelled it. I'd never smelled it before
smelled
in my life.
You and your buddies, everybody, you could smell it.
Yeah. I mean, I smelled this smell and I was like, man, that's fear. And I recognized it immediately. Right. And then I was like, holy shit, that's me.
What does it smell like? Like metallic or?
No, it's like, you know, if you go to the gym and you work out and you get that kind of sweaty smell.
Yes.
And then you don't shower for like 4 days.
Yes.
You just like take that and amplify it by 100. It's very organic.
It's almost like what a skunk does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, that's a good analogy.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay. So, but it doesn't seem as gamey. Like you're saying the gym sort of the.
Yeah. It's definitely very human.
It's definitely very human.
But it's also very putrid.
It's putrid.
Yeah, it's gross.
Oh, shit. Oh, my God. So you could, it was, everybody could smell it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. It was just coming out of your pores.
Yeah.
Just all backed up. Just like you hadn't felt fear and all of a sudden you did.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So. Oh, well, that's something to consider.
Mm-hmm.
And then that sounds obviously very terrifying. To me, of course, I've been desensitized by video games and movies.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So I totally feel like I would have just jumped over the wall and karate chopped everybody. But
you probably should. I wish you were there.
Yeah, if I was there.
I would let you go all across the wall.
We would have gotten to dinner a little earlier. Brad, go get him. All right.
Yeah.
But as far as, these are... That's just two of what I'm assuming is a long stream of stories. You said you were relieved in 2004. The war gets started in 2003. So had you just been around for a while?
Yeah, so I was in the military since 99.
Right. So this was like sort of the end of your career, and this war happens to start.
Yeah, basically. I was, since I was in the reserves, I was still actually...
99, when was Bosnia? 97?
That was, I think, earlier in the 90s.
Right.
Yeah, that was still in the Clinton years.
Right, okay.
I should remember. Yeah.
You came right in as Bush. You came to the tail end of the Clinton administration.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
No wars. Everybody had a lot of money.
Well.
Just joking.
That's funny. Well, you know, I always find this funny about politics. You know, we've got Bill Clinton, who's the Democrat.
All right.
Who most people don't realize we had more than 20 presidential call-ups during the Clinton years.
What is a presidential call-up?
So, like, Iraq and Afghanistan were presidential call-ups. These were combat actions initiated by the president.
That's the 7 train, folks. Oh, no.
Yes, that's the 7 train. That is the 7 train. I've actually wanted to start, like, a production company here and call it 7 Train Productions.
Right.
Where we'd always have the 7 train in the background so people would know it's not edited.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is unedited
this
stuff.
This is unedited.
Exactly right.
Yeah, there's the train to prove
no
it.
No editing. Don't get me in that room.
Right.
What were you saying? I'm sorry.
So there's more than 20 presidential call-ups.
Mm-hmm.
There was Bosnia. There was Somalia. There was Mogadishu. There are all these call-ups, but the press didn't make a big deal out of them, I think in part because
the call-up
was,
just means we're going to attack these people without congressional approval.
That's right.
Okay.
So that happened more than 20 times under Clinton.
Right.
It only happened 2 times under Bush. But what kind of blows my mind is...
It's sort of the Kennedy kind of with the Bay of Pigs stuff, too.
Yeah, right. So it's like, you know, we've got the Democrat who balances the budget,
right,
which is typically a conservative thing to do.
Wars.
And does these 20 call-ups, right? You know, and then we've got the conservative, Bush, who, like, expands federal power beyond what's ever been seen in this country,
right.
Which is a more liberal thing to do.
Right.
And he, you know, has less of these actions. So, you know, the way we see these things, I feel like these presidents are very...
Well, all that stuff is politicized. I mean, every single issue that these guys get involved with is just a politicized issue. It's all boogeymen, left and right. It's like, the taxes seem to stay the same. I mean, right now there's some stuff happening, obviously.
Sure, there's a few things going on.
That you can't just go, well, no, it's always the same.
Right.
This is not the same. But, that's probably true. And I mean, you know, realistically, I was a child during the Clinton administration. But as far as like, being in that situation, you were there for, that's a 5-year tour or tour is
no.
when you leave.
Tour is my time in Iraq was a tour, right? Yep.
And how long was that?
I was there for about 9 months in Iraq.
Yeah.
All's good over there?
Everything's great. Okay, yeah, don't even worry about this stuff. This is just me trying to figure this out because it's a new update. Right. I want to make sure that we're dealing with actual time instead of measures.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And now I can't figure that out anymore.
You can't do that math in your head? Samples to seconds?
I can't. I just, no? I think I just turned on the metronome.
Oh.
Let's see here. Okay, there it is. Time. Yeah, just give me the time. There you go.
Go. Okay, great. You know, so I joined in 99. I took a administrative discharge in 2004 because of my injury. So after the brick, there was a couple explosions I went through.
How bad was he? I mean, the injury, did you have a concussion and you forget things? And
well, not immediately. What they know about brain injuries is that usually like the first impact makes you more susceptible to a brain injury.
Yeah.
And it's like the multiple exposures to blasts or to concussive effects is what causes the injury in the end. So,
okay.
So I had like three explosions plus the brick. the last explosion was huge. I mean, that one left me dizzy for days, but we left the next day, so I didn't really worry about it. And when I came back, I knew things weren't quite right. I had this heart arrhythmia. I was just not thinking clearly. I just didn't feel well. And, my mom would call me every morning, for like the next year, trying to check up on me, just how am I doing? How am I doing? And after about a year, she's like, son, do you want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I was like, why would I do that? And so she would call me every morning trying to get me to go AA.
Were you having drinking problems?
No. So I was like, apparently I was slurring my speech and I had no idea.
Oh,
so she would call every morning at 9 o'clock and she just thought I'd been hitting the bottle.
Oh, you were like, hang on.
Yeah.
Oh
so,
my God.
So anyway, so then this is kind of, I knew I had the heart arrhythmia. They always assumed that the dizziness that I had was from the heart arrhythmia because I got parasites when I was there, which did some heart valve damage.
Parasites.
Yeah, those were not fun. I do not recommend.
They crawl into you and they latch onto your heart?
Apparently. So.
What? In Iraq?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Not a vacation destination.
No, probably not. I was about 175 pounds, during the war. When I came home over those next months, I dropped and dropped and dropped until I hit below 130. And, so for my situation is a little more complicated because they just thought the dizziness and the cognitive stuff was related to just being undernourished from the parasites.
Yeah.
But after those were treated and then the cognitive stuff persisted, that's eventually when I got diagnosed with the TBI.
TBI.
Right.
And again, what does TBI stand for?
Oh, so this is traumatic brain injury?
Traumatic brain injury. You had it. You still probably suffer from it a little bit.
I still have some deficits. I ended up going to speech therapy and occupational therapy. Mm-hmm.
Your speaking is incredible.
Great.
There's no trace of it at all. Yeah.
I had to work for a couple of years to get it back.
Yeah. And how do you do that? You listen to yourself or you were like, I saw the King's speech, but I mean, I'm assuming there's more to it than that.
Sure. there's a lot of it is just kind of really clarifying what you're going to do before you do it. For me, it was a lot of taking notes and just writing everything down.
Yeah.
And most of my deficits now, I thought I had memory issues, but when I went to the speech therapists and the neuropsychology, they said my memory was perfect. And I was like, that's impossible. I can't remember anything. And right. For me, what the issue was is my concentration was apparently so bad, I couldn't even hold anything long enough in my concentration to get it into memory in the first place.
Wow.
So as I learned to improve my concentration and did exercises and things to work on that, that's how I started to relieve my own symptoms.
And the concentration, is an issue. What were the exercises that you did with that to improve concentration? So that you could, eventually put thoughts into memories or transform thoughts into memories.
Sure. So for me, there's a lot of stuff involved, like I was not physically healthy, and so I had to deal with my physical health.
Right.
I ended up changing my diet, started eating what's called a whole foods plant-based diet, which did wonders for my just general well-being.
Right.
That stuff
you feel right out of the gate.
Yeah. Then I had to actually deal with anxiety issues from the war because the more anxiety you have, uh-huh. the more it kind of disrupts your concentration.
So that's meditation.
It was. There was meditation.
Breathing.
Exercise is actually part of dealing with the anxiety. I did a lot of breathing.
Physical exercise.
Yeah, you get physical exercise.
100%.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you get all these stress hormones in your body, and when you exercise, it burns off the stress hormones, and your anxiety levels come down.
And yes, it does.
Yeah. So.
And you were just like chilling out. You were like, "Look, I got hit in the head with a brick. Nobody bother me." Right.
No, I kept going. I've never stopped.
Well, I mean, when your mom called, you were like, "Ah, there's nothing wrong with me." But, you know, it was. You needed to change your diet. You needed to get back on.
Yeah, I mean, I never stopped. I never put anything on hold in my life. But it was, but yeah, things were not right.
Yeah.
You know, I was actually passing out in the streets of Manhattan. I'd wake up in the emergency room. It was craziness.
Oh, my gosh. It's terrible. This is what so many people go through.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, are you taking care? Is the government taking care of you?
Well, it's still in process. You know, it took after the military, it took 3 years of appeals for me to get a medical discharge. I got an admin SEP, so it took 3 years of appeals to get the medical discharge.
Oh, so they didn't want to let you go. They were like, hey, come on. We just started this war. You got to stick with us.
No, I got kicked out. Right. I got kicked out administratively.
Administratively?
But there was no, yeah, which basically means you did a good job, but we're going to send you on your way now. But it wasn't a medical discharge. So it took 3 years of fighting.
Oh, because it's not a medical discharge. So then they're like, we're just going to let you go.
Right.
Have a great life. Here's some pension or something.
No, nothing.
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 They're just like, hey, hope you had a good time.
Yes, basically.
Right?
So then it took 3 years to get that reversed and I got a medical discharge.
Do you think that they did the administrative discharge on purpose?
I don't think there was foul play in my case. I just think my case was really complicated because I was in the reserves. And so as soon as we got back, we were immediately put back into the reserves. And so then my symptoms got worse and worse over time because the parasites grew. Right. It was complicated. But then it was certainly mismanaged after that point.
Right.
You know, it was certainly mismanaged. So then after that, I went to the VA, but it took 4 years for me to get approval in the VA. So I didn't get benefits or access to care at the VA until 2009. Which was, you know, 6 years after the war.
And the whole time you're there, so the whole time that you're doing that, you're paying out of pocket and you're just making your own way as far as like, I guess I got to exercise and eat grass.
I took a step up and went for lettuce. I mean, I was broke in that time, so maybe I should have gone for the grass.
Right. But, right. You're broke and you've got a music degree.
Yeah, now I've got three of them.
Right? So, you know, as far as that's concerned, it, you know, we could definitely stay there forever, as far as I'm concerned, and talk about that stuff. But you did eventually get help. But that, so 2004 happens, you come back, you're making your way on your own. You're seeing what doctors you can without any sort of insurance, I'm assuming, or anything.
I had insurance for a company I was working for. And then I...
What was that?
So it was Empire Blue Cross was the insurance company.
So you worked for them?
No, I worked for the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company. And then I moved to New York City and was hired by a big real estate developer. And they had the same insurance policy.
What real estate developer doing what?
I was doing property management.
Okay. You're doing property management. Right.
Correct.
So that means you get an apartment out of the deal?
No apartment out of the deal.
No apartment.
No, it would have been nice.
They just, you go by, you fix things.
It was commercial real estate, so it wasn't, yeah.
You were actually managing the people that fix things.
Correct.
Okay. You were like, yeah, sitting there going,
it was contracts, it was cleaning, it was window repairs.
Multiple
it was,
buildings.
It was, yeah, it was, you know, it was collecting rents from the tenants, that sort of thing.
Okay, so you weren't just some, you know, some guy who lives in the bottom of the building.
No.
His mother lives next to the washing room. Washing machine.
That might have been a better deal.
He basically doesn't return your calls for 5 days, and then maybe he'll fix the water at the end of the week.
You know, I probably would have gotten more practice in that way. Now that you bring it up,
right? But as far as so you property management you did out of the gate. How'd you like that job?
That one I didn't like at all. That one was. I ended up getting let go from that job.
Yeah.
I kind of made the mistake of believing I could trust the people I worked with, and I didn't. That just wasn't the case.
I don't think the real estate in New York is like just the sleaziest thing.
Yeah,
you know, it's.
So yeah, so look, I got
yeah,
like, look, yeah. It was politics.
Look at our boy in the White House. This is.
That's right. He did come from that world, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. It's just sleaze, and I mean, it's not just. I mean, he didn't really come from the world we're talking about. I mean, the only access that I have to the real estate market is just total sleaze.
Mm-hmm.
You know. No offense.
None taken.
But none taken. I mean, you know, like you, yeah. So that was the problem: is the people you were working with, and just yeah, just the undercutting and
yeah. So it was politics. Stuff. I got forced out. I can't say which company it was because when they let me go, they gave me this amazing contract, which was, if you don't tell the circumstances of your termination for a full 2 years, they gave me rent for the next year. They pay for my benefits for the next year. They gave me a headhunter for 3 months. They gave me a moving allowance to reimburse my move from New Orleans to New York City. They gave me all this stuff, all in the condition I tell no one what happened.
So you weren't telling anybody what happened?
Nope. but this is how I went back to grad school.
Yeah.
You know, so that
with my, that money. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, I still had to pay tuition, but
you had a place to live without having
to
go to work.
I had a place to live
for
a year.
Right.
Right. So that was the good that came out of it. So that's how I got back to the music world.
Yeah. Oh, great. Oh my God. How great.
Yeah.
So, but as far as getting that job, how did you even, I mean, that seems like, how did you even get that job out of the, coming out of the army?
That was through my other job. So the...
What town did you... You said you didn't come straight to New York. Where'd you go?
I grew up in Texas. Well,
you're Texas?
Yeah, I came from Texas.
Austin or what?
Around there. A small town called Fredericksburg. So I split
my
time.
I've been to Fredericksburg. I stayed at a bed and breakfast there with my college girlfriend.
What was the name of the bed and breakfast? Because that's my parents' own.
I don't know. Let me tell you what it looked like.
Okay.
Oh, geez. Okay. We were like in our own sort of... Maybe each cottage has two rooms.
But they were separate cottages?
Yes.
Pecan trees in the middle?
Probably.
Main house with a kitchen in
main
it?
Main house has a kitchen in it, and then...
Was it at the very edge of town?
I think so. I don't think it was like in the antique stores.
Okay, yeah. So, was it right next to the newspaper company?
I don't know about that, because this was 1998. So okay. It was...
Was it called Camp David?
Isn't Camp David an army base? No, that's where the president's retreat
is. Yeah, yeah.
It was called. The woman was a little bit heavier set with gray hair. Is that your mom?
No.
Okay, I don't know if that's true. That's just what I picture. Maybe that's just all bed and breakfasts. And the bathtub was an old bathtub.
Oh no, they had jacuzzis. So.
Was it a jacuzzi? It might have been a jacuzzi because we did some. Yeah, I think I don't know. Maybe okay. Maybe right. It was.
Maybe yeah.
Who
so
knows?
Yeah. But no, have, if it's that description,
I'll have
you
no
know,
way
like,
of knowing.
Yeah.
but yeah, multiple units. Each unit had two
rooms.
Each. This is probably boring the shit out of everybody. Who cares though? They can deal with it. It's each house, a couple of houses. Each house, I think, had two places for people to stay. Two rooms.
Okay.
Is that you?
No, I think these were one-bedroom cottages.
No.
Okay, so no. Not the same one.
No. And I was a college kid. I remember It was like the most expensive thing I'd ever done. But I was like, you know, I'm a romantic.
Yeah, Let's
take it. And it's right next to the Rock. What do you call that? The Flat Rock place?
Enchanted Rock.
Enchanted Rock.
Yes.
Yes, so that was the thing. I was like, let's go to a bed and breakfast at Enchanted Rock.
Yeah, it's an amazing place.
This will secure me, this girl, for the next year.
Did it?
No. Oh. We broke up like a couple months later. I think it was a last ditch effort. Mm-hmm, anyway, mm-hmm. But as far as you're Fredericksburg, Texas, right?
Yeah.
Great place. You are of German descent, so I'm assuming your people had been there for a while.
That's
had a grandpa
correct,
there and everything
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, so my grandfather was one of the immigrants, came over as a really, really little kid.
Yeah,
but basically I think they were trying to escape the political issues in Northern Europe at the time.
Right. Okay, great. So that was the thing, too, is that they were just trying to get out of it. I mean, that's everybody in Texas, yeah.
Well, I think that's how Texas becomes so independent and free, is that these people came from Europe at a time of really severe political oppression,
yeah.
And they found a lot of these cities
in a much more recent
time
than they did to Boston or whatever.
Right.
We're talking, you know, 100 years later.
Correct.
Right. And so that was your people.
That's right. That's right.
Trying to hide from what was going on. But as far as, I mean, that's great. So as far as getting out of the army, you go back to Fredericksburg. You get involved. Somebody says, hey, I got some real estate stuff you can do. Over there, it's kind of nice, kind of friendly, kind of homey. Somebody offers you a job in New York, and then you get into the New York real estate market where it's just a bunch of crazies.
Yeah, it was close to that. You know, I was actually working at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company as their director of purchasing.
Which is based in...
So they have 54 properties all over there. Right. So I was in New Orleans at that time. I actually was looking to transfer up to the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City.
Right.
They made me an offer. I didn't think it was a fair offer, and that's right. When I got hired away by the real estate company.
Right. So the real estate company got okay. So right. Then you get here, you go to grad, we already talked about how you got the money to go to grad school, not the money, but the money to live, the free apartment, all that stuff. Where was that? What neighborhood was that in? Here?
Where I was living?
Mm-hmm.
I was living on the Upper West Side at the time.
Upper West Side, there you
yes.
go. Okay, you're in the Upper West Side. You're right there with all the colleges. Where'd you go to grad school?
I went to Queens College.
You went to Queens?
Nowhere near the Upper West Side or those schools that you're talking
all
about.
All three conservatories. You're like, I'm going to Queens.
Yeah.
You went to Queens College.
That's right.
Right. And who's there? Who's the guy there?
I studied, well, actually, I went for a composition degree. Mm-hmm. But while I was there, I had the good fortune to meet Bill Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And studied guitar with Bill. And uh-huh. I did composition with Bruce Saylor and Jeff Nichols.
Bruce Saylor and Jeff Nichols.
Correct.
Let's talk about composition.
Sure.
You made the decision to study composition instead of more solo guitar.
What's
up with that? Was that just, you know, you're older, you sort of like the perspective of just like, why am I here and what am I doing? Which is why I started composing. I was like,
I feel in many ways like that. For me, composition is just more persistent. You know, like I feel it's like you can produce something and you can keep working on it and it's something that sticks around, you know,
right.
Whereas performances just evaporate into thin air. And I think there's something great about performances.
Yeah.
I love those much more than recordings, actually.
Yeah.
For me, composition is it's in many ways much more of an influencer than it's performing.
Yeah. Well, it's straight up creative.
Yeah.
It's no question about it. The other one's interpretive. But did you ever give a lot of recitals or is that something that you didn't have too much time with?
I did. Part of my work when I came back was I was gigging, you know, I can't tell you how many wedding gigs I did in Long Island. I've done tons of weddings, tons of bars and restaurants and that's part of the way I paid my way through grad school was this kind of work. Which always paid way more than the new music stuff I was doing. You know, and people are always way more appreciative at the same time. You know, you play someone's wedding, you make their life, you know, and you play like a concert of music for PhD composers and it's like, you missed one note and they're all angry about it, you know?
Yeah.
So the graduate work was for free and the weddings were a lot of money. So it's, you know, it's
right.
Very, very different worlds.
Very different world. But as far as playing the weddings, what do you think? I had sort of the opposite experience. I didn't play that many. Who'd you go with? You go with gig masters? How'd you get your wedding?
I did gig masters. Mm-hmm. I built my own website, got some work through there.
Like a whole wedding-y website.
Right.
So if they went to your website, it wasn't just about this artist guy. It was about actual weddings and stuff like that. That's
no,
a good idea.
Yeah. And then I also just started cold calling wedding planners.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's like, I mean, they book more weddings. So why?
Is that a dog or is that kids?
I think that's kids down the hallway.
Oh, that's what you were talking about in the email.
Was I?
You emailed me and you
said. I don't remember
this.
And
I read the first part of the email again just because I'm working 13 hours a day.
Right.
I read the first part of the email you got. I'm real close to Greenpoint. I'm right across the bridge. And I was like, it sounds perfect.
Oh, right. That's right. Because, yeah, we have the other location of the school down
the
there.
Rest,
but it's
the rest it's, of your email says, I think we're going to get a terrible recording. There will be screaming kids.
Right.
Which I read today, that part of the email. So I was like, this guy must think I'm crazy. Because you were like, it's going to be a terrible recording. And there's going to be screaming children. And I write back, sounds perfect. I didn't do a very good job setting this up. I apologize.
No worry. This works out great.
We have a cancellation and, you know, 15 minutes late. It's just a different time. That is beautiful. You guys hear that? That's the sound of being a guitarist.
That's right.
Screaming children.
That's right.
So if you can't deal with it for a half an hour, turn it off and go away because we got to deal with it all day. But so then you go to grad school at Queens College. You're getting what? What are you getting? What are you getting? You're getting a master's in composition.
I got a master's in composition.
And as far as studying that, what did you get out of, you know, I went to grad school for performance.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when you go to grad school for composition? I mean, you've already studied counterpoint. Do you just do that again?
It was more of that, you know. Yeah. I
do you use counterpoint a lot, or do you just use your ear?
I both. Yeah. For me, it's like making my own rules of how each piece works. You know, I think when you look at like species counterpoint or 18th century counterpoint, you're looking at how someone else did it,
right?
You know, so that's more exercisey than it is, I think, useful. But at least gets you to think,
right?
You know, on the other hand, I don't remember much about grad school because of the brain injury. So,
is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's a lot of vacancy, you know, during those years.
What year is that one more time?
So this is 2004 to 2006.
So this is right out of the gate, dude.
Right.
Okay. So at this point, you're still getting better. You're still trying to figure out whether or not you can.
Yeah. I mean, back then, my health was so bad. I honestly did not I did not believe I would live to be 30. I mean, that's how bad everything was during that time.
Were doctors telling you that, or were you just?
No, I mean, it was just me. It was like I was with the passing out. Like I would live in a fuzz. Like my hands and face and feet were numb all the time.
And you were like, oh, this is not. Yeah. Other people my age don't look like this.
Right. Or don't feel like this, you know.
Right, right.
Most people thought I was fine, but man, I was suffering so much on the inside. Yeah. You know, I had difficulty breathing. Like, you know, you just breathe and it happens normally.
Yeah.
You know, for periods of my life, like I wouldn't breathe without doing it consciously.
Yeah.
You know, and that was one of the tougher things because I could never relax because I always had to like just actively breathe.
Yeah.
And that was tough.
And that's really hard as far as from a concentration standpoint too, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So surviving was like a lot of my concentration. It wasn't just doing things. It was like just living was a big part of my, with that time. Yeah.
And as far as the dog is concerned, how old is Bijou here?
She's going to be 3 years in April.
She is up in my face wanting a kiss. You can't get a kiss. I will snuggle with you for sure. I'm all about it. And she's a sheddy dog, too.
Oh, man, that's the one unfortunate part.
Oh, I hate it. Yeah, I had a beagle growing up, so I'm used to it. But it's like, I wore black today, too.
Uh-huh.
All right, come here.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Just get yeah. it. You put your paw on my face, you might as well lick it now. There you go. Oh, I love it. I need a dog. I wonder if my landlord will let me have a dog. So you got another degree, too. You said did you go all the way? Are you a doctor?
No, I took some PhD courses at the grad center thinking I was going to do it, but I was already working at that point. You know, I'd already got the gig at CUNY, you know, since I already had the...
Where are you working at CUNY?
I've been at a few different campuses. I've been at City College and Queens College, and now I'm currently at LaGuardia.
Okay,
and
great.
So I'm teaching music over there.
Teaching composition or guitar?
I'm actually teaching musicianship theory, history.
Right.
You know, more of the more academic courses.
Yeah.
They don't really have a performance program, so there's
I would love to do that. That would be... I think that's where I...
It's just you knew...
I'm just tired. I mean, doing the guitar lessons,
mm-hmm.
it's great, but actually, like, the performance aspect of being in front of an audience of college kids sounds great, right? Isn't it fun?
It is fun. Actually, it is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get to talk about a lot more than just music. You know, I like to be able to take, like, I like to be able to tell the history of the world through music.
That's kind of
how I run my history courses, you know, so.
Yeah, that's always been the interesting thing about music history, is how it relates to the Medicis or whatever is going on.
Or
Frederick the Great or whatever.
Right, or when Beethoven tells off the emperor or, you know, 40 short years earlier where Haydn was basically owned by the emperor, you know, just that kind of difference in their lives is kind of incredible.
Yeah. And that's the way historical fiction works, you know, works along that line of the idea of here is a, you know, sort of an artistic story, a story of sacrifice, blah, blah, blah. But then the backdrop is the setting of history.
Right.
So you get to learn and enjoy yourself at the same time.
It's amazing. Yes.
How did you get those gigs out of the, you know, coming out of that? Was that just, you know, you knew people from going there? And
so for me, yeah, I knew people from going
you're
there.
You're SUNY all the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I knew people.
Which is the benefit of actually going to like a college that's maybe not a conservatory is you do, you're going to get a little more attention.
Well, the other thing I find that's interesting is that I feel like people who go to schools like the one I went to mm-hmm. are working people.
Yeah.
You know, and they have to work. And mm-hmm. so I feel like there's a much better sense of community and people I think we're really working to help each other out in a way I haven't seen at the conservatories.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was a pretty good support network that developed from my time there.
As far as, so you still have friends and stuff from that time that you're pretty close to.
Sure.
And you're an active member of the Guitar Society and stuff like that.
Correct.
You lead the guitar orchestra. How does that, how did you sort of get involved with that aspect?
So, I mean, I got into conducting basically through the new music world.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go on a gig and, you know, every piece had strings and winds and percussion and one piece on a concert would have a guitar.
Right.
And so while I'm sitting there doing nothing, and of course this is like really, really difficult music, you know,
yeah.
someone would be like, oh my God, please conduct. please conduct. We need someone just to make us more comfortable because we're, you know, they're struggling because it's like, it was just super, super hard music. You know, it was like on the lines of, you know, Babbitt, Warren and that kind of stuff.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the really hard stuff.
Right.
And so I got into conducting by just kind of starting to swing my arms like this. And this really difficult music.
Had you ever taken a conducting class? Or
I did take some conducting with. I took one conducting course in college,
in my
master's degree, and then I ended up taking some private lessons with Jacques-Louis Monod, who some people think is the greatest conductor of 20th century music ever.
Yeah,
he's a little bit crazy, but it was really kind of an incredible experience to work with him.
You're taking conducting lessons. You know, when I took that class, I think I took it, it was a whole year, so I took two semesters of it. But what are you guys doing? Like, how does he teach? Is he talking about, like, is he just, you're looking at the score and he's showing you things to bring out and he's showing you how to interpret things? Is it more of an interpretive lesson?
There was talk about interpretation.
Or is there an actual physical?
It was both.
Right, so when you're physically thinking, there's like a plane of water, one person told me, and you make sure you're always on the same plane.
There's talk about ictus, you know, to always show the beats in the same place. You know, but that was very basic. But for him, it was often about how do you move in such a way that the flute player knows that you're only talking to them and not to anyone else.
Right.
Right. So how do you make the movements in such a way that it's the movement evokes trumpet or cello or...
Oh.
You know, so now I actually do this with the orchestra.
And is that just his approach, or is that just like a general approach where you're actually acting out what you want these horns to do and communicating?
I think
them
he does it more than most other conductors I've seen. You know, a lot of conductors can be really, really expressive, and sometimes I find that distracting.
Right.
I learned a lot about conducting from the military. I see these military band conductors, and they make such small, precise movements, but when they do something big, the band reacts.
Right.
And I think that's so impressive.
Yeah.
I think that's so impressive.
Restraint and through restraint, you know, big.
Yes.
At some point.
That's right.
But as far, I mean, that's cool, dude. Everything you've done, I want to do now.
All right.
Okay.
I won't stop you.
You have the best, I mean, this is like the best interview because you have an actual, I'm going to go on for a while. As far as taking the conducting lessons. And you did that after you had sort of been...
This was after grad school.
But, I mean, after actual teaching a guitar orchestra? Or what are we talking about?
No, so I started doing the conducting lessons after I'd been thrown into these conducting situations.
That's right, conducting situations. Right. And then, you're like, I want to do better at this. There's got to be more than 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes. Right. And then I saw the Guitar Society started...
Right.
They decided to build an orchestra.
Okay.
And they said, we're looking for a conductor.
Yeah.
I was like, that's me.
Yeah.
You know, that's me.
Yeah.
You know, I'd already conducted some pickup guitar orchestras. So I'd conducted two different guitar orchestras at Carnegie Hall in the previous years.
Right.
So I had some experience with that, and I had the new music experience already.
Right.
So I was like, yeah, I applied. And they brought me on. And it's been really kind of an incredible project because John Olson, who's the president, really gives me a lot of leeway in terms of the artistic direction.
Good.
As far as
what your pieces select and stuff like that?
That's right. So basically I arrange almost everything that isn't composed for specifically, but we also have a grant, and every year we get 3 or 4 new pieces written just for our group.
Oh.
And that's so exciting. That's really exciting.
That's exciting. And as far as the way you've got it organized, how many parts do you have?
It depends on the composer. I think the biggest.
For how many people in the orchestra in general?
It grows and contracts, you know, based on the season. But right now we have about 32 folks.
32 folks, and then you know, you said it depends on the composer. What's the maximum amount of parts that you've ever?
The biggest one we had is by the composer Takuma Tanakawa. I actually met him at Queens College.
Right. And what a part is, folks, is a part is the situation where you have. Say it's a quartet, right? That means that there's 4 parts written, and then you can have multiple people
on each
playing
part.
Exactly the same thing on each part. So right now, you know, you said that there was a Japanese composer.
Right. Takuma Tanakawa.
Tanakawa.
His piece was called Mist. Actually, I've got a great story I wrote on the website for my school about this piece because it's very aphoristic, and the orchestra used to they used to kind of joke with me. They would say, we're mystified, you know, when they were trying to learn the piece, or they would miss a note and say, oh, it's missed.
Oh, God.
So,
well, that's a guitar society.
It is, yeah. So, right. bunch of jokesters.
Oh, they're funny.
Yeah, but that piece has how many? It has 8 parts total.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm expected to play the 9th part. So there's 8 parts, and at the end of the piece, I actually turn around and face the audience and improvise a cadenza for the ending of the piece.
And the conductor's supposed to do it.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay, so he's got some crazy. He's got a whole thing in mind.
Yes, he has a whole thing in mind.
Love him. Love him. You met him?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, we actually met at Queens College.
Yorker?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, cool.
That's right.
Man, that's great stuff. And then, so that's sort of where you know, let me go back to the conducting lessons real quick, and then we'll probably end it kind of there. If there's anything else you want to talk about, I'd love to talk about it. But with the conducting, what? It's just the dumbest question. But I want to know.
Sure.
All right? Because to be honest with you, when you see people conducting, mm-hmm. some people, like you said, you see the beats, you see everything happen on time. What is it with all these things? It seems like they're conducting things like a beat ahead or a beat behind what's actually happening in front of them. Is that what's am I seeing that happen? It seems like they're off with the orchestra.
Yeah.
What is that about?
So some conductors will like make a really obvious preparation. Like they'll show something a beat before it's supposed to happen. So mm-hmm. they see it, next beat they do it.
That happened. That's crazy.
I typically kind of do like a small prep. So my process is like I prepare and then I show. So it's like it's like you now, where some people are like you're next, but they're not actually showing it when it happens. They're just giving people a beat ahead. But
I can understand like making eye contact and holding up your left hand to somebody like, and then doing that. But I can't really understand the whole idea of like actually conducting ahead of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're doing, right?
Yeah, sometimes.
That's
now if they're behind, I think this is totally a bad situation. But but if they're ahead,
they're like following the orchestra. Yeah. Like, this is great.
But I also see situations where I actually have to conduct ahead. If there's, you know, if there's a lot of cues, the music is really complex, mm-hmm. but you have to talk through these things. You have to say, you know, I'm going to cue you early just so you know, because I've got to make 2 other cues in the next like half a second. Mm-hmm.
And then you rehearse the conducting routine.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Right.
But I think a lot of conducting we see, especially like famous conductors, I think part of that's show, you know, because all the real work happens in the rehearsal.
Right.
And you just kind of make them comfortable in the performance. And I think that audiences love to see the big gestures. And so I think that becomes part of the performance.
So the big gestures and almost, you know, yeah, working. I guess I get it a little bit. I still feel like a lot of them are doing things that are not in the, like not happening in the music at the time that they're uh-huh. doing it. It's crazy. I don't get it. I'm talking about big orchestra guys
sure.
and stuff like that.
Sure.
And as far as your conducting style, I'm sure that you sound like you're lean towards a milder approach as far as like, you know, the big gestures and stuff like that.
Yeah. For me, I'm very technical, very right. clear. Right. You know, I feel like we talk through musical issues and my job is just to give them just what they need.
Right. And eventually you started this school.
Right.
Sage Music.
That's correct.
Right now we're in a beautiful office. Sun coming down. Looks like we got some southern exposure happening here.
We do.
I love it. I'm a big fan of southern exposure.
Me too. So are the plants.
Right. the beautiful building. The Long Island Arts Center.
The building is the Long Island City Arts Center.
Long Island City Arts Center.
Correct.
Beautiful. Right off the 7. You got the diner over here, the famous diner.
That's right.
What's the diner called?
This one's called Court Square Diner.
Court Square Diner.
Pretty much every other movie that has a diner is filmed there.
Right. That or Dorian's.
Dorian's too, yes.
I see Dorian's a lot. Dorian's is the first stop in Long Island City, Vernon Jackson.
On the 7.
And Luke Cage is like, mm-hmm. It's like a comic book Netflix series. It's always at Dorian's. It's great.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah, we do. A lot of things are filmed in Long Island City and Greenpoint.
Right.
A lot of things.
Yeah, because there's Silver Cup and Kaufman Studios, like the two biggest studios in New York City are right here.
Yeah. So they'll do that. They'll use this area a lot because it's got a classic feel to it. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been overdeveloped yet. So you can actually feel like you're in, you know, old school Brooklyn or downtown Manhattan a lot.
Right.
Or Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.
And you know, as far as starting Sage Music, I mean, what's the what do you go for here? Is this just private lessons?
Sure, it is. I'd actually like to connect the military and the school here because this is this is kind of how it happened. Well, okay. so after the brain injury, I had all these deficits, I had all these difficulties, and even when I went to speech therapy and occupational therapy, these things, it wasn't that much help.
Yeah.
So I started doing all the research I could into how the human mind learns, you know, how we form habits, how we form skills, how we form memories, because I needed that for myself, my own recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started applying that to my students. And then my student body grew and I started getting referrals and then I couldn't keep up with the referrals. And so I brought on another teacher. And so the school grew organically.
Right.
But for me, really what the school is about is that, you know, right now there's two ways that someone becomes a music teacher. It's like you get a performance degree and they're like, oh, I'll go teach. Or, you know, because there aren't so many performance jobs, I'm sure you know.
Yes, and, I know. I found that out the hard way.
Yeah, we all do. Or you get a music education degree, which has nothing to do with the private lesson. It's about classroom management and meeting state standards and adolescent psychology. It's not about teaching private lessons. And so there's no real training track. You know, there's really no way to prepare people to teach private lessons. And so I've kind of taken the literature and the research and codified it and distilled it for the practice of teaching private lessons.
Wow.
So I train the teachers here how to teach. And so in that way, we have a real product. And, you know, my big goal is really changing the way education is done, teachers. And so, you know, the students can expect to get a certain level of quality, a very high quality, I think, when they come here.
Yeah.
But also, you know, when I first started teaching, I was going to like 5 schools with 4 students each. You know, mm-hmm. So I'm also working to build all of my faculty into full-time positions. They can concentrate just on teaching. They can have insurance. They can have benefits because these things stabilize people's lives. And the more stable they are, the better they'll be able to function as teachers.
Right. Yeah. That's huge. So you're talking about a teacher-centric program too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And being a teacher yourself.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, I feel my job is to take care of the teachers.
Yes.
To train them, to enable them so they can in turn take care of the students, you know, and every other
and not have to do what I'm doing, which is a 13-hour day.
Right.
You know, and impossible. Like eventually that's not sustainable.
Yeah. This is why people don't make it in this industry. It's just because you got 8 jobs freelancing.
Right.
No benefits, no stability.
Broke all the time.
Yeah.
No work in the summer. I mean, that's the killer.
Mm-hmm.
Is the summer. How do you deal with that?
For the summer, what we do is we have a concert series.
Okay. Yeah. You were telling me about that.
Yeah. So we have a concert series here in Long Island City on the waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is we get businesses because they're also slow.
Now, what's the waterfront? Is the waterfront the old beach bar area?
No, I don't think they have any beachy bars. It's guaranteed.
There used to be a beach bar down here.
Oh, was there? I didn't know that.
Yeah, like where they imported sand from the Jersey Shore.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Huh. Like 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's Gantry Plaza State Park. We get businesses in the neighborhood. They sponsor the concert series. And that drives people into the neighborhood when the restaurants and bars are already slow. So it's a boost for them. And we use that money to pay the musicians.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And to promote the series.
So you've got your boys, your girls and your boys, you got them when they're not teaching, they're playing.
As best I can. That's right.
Oh, look at you're doing it. You're saving us.
I'm trying.
Save us. Save us, Jason. Well, so is there anything else going on as far as you? What's happening?
You know, the moment it's really my big focus now is like
you married and got kids and all that
no,
all that stuff?
No, no, no.
Oh
no.
Me neither.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. Roommate.
You
got a roommate?
I have a semi roommate.
Oh yeah.
I just moved in this new place. I think they were trying to convert it into a 3 family, but it's only legal for 2, so it's like they stopped halfway through. So I've technically got 2 roommates. But I've got a separate entrance, separate bathroom.
Oh, forget about it.
A private backyard.
Oh, you got your own backyard?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I just need to move to Queens. I need to give this Brooklyn thing up, right? It's too hard. It's so expensive.
I did 2 years in Brooklyn. I have to say, man, living here in Queens, it's so much easier.
It's cheaper.
It's easier to work. It's cheaper.
Yeah.
It just, in general, my life is so much better being here.
Oh, good. That's good to know. Maybe I'll do it. I just moved to Brooklyn a couple of years ago, so I'm going to stay for a while. I mean, I love all that cool stuff a little bit too much.
Yeah.
But you do too. You seem like a cool guy.
Yeah, but I like to go down and do the cool and come back to where it's quiet, you know? I don't like to sleep in the cool, you know?
Yeah, sleeping in the cool. Yeah, exactly. Well, it was a total pleasure meeting you. It was great.
You as well.
What a wonderful interview. Total fun. I'll probably have to edit out every time I talk because I'm so out of it. I haven't done this in so long, but, you know, we'll see. I liked everything you said.
Oh, well, great. Well, and I just want to know, are you going to edit out the part about you editing out the parts? Or does that part stay in?
I probably am lazy and I'll just keep the whole damn thing.
All right. Sounds good.
All right, Jason. All right. Great meeting you, pal. Right,
you too, Brett.
All right. So that does it for my time with Jason. I hope you guys had a good time. I'll be back when I'm back. It might be, you know, a little while. Andrew York was in town, unfortunately, because of the snow. We weren't able to do our interview. He'll be back in April. So hopefully I get together with him. But in the meantime, I'm doing my best. I'm doing my best. I hope that things, I don't know, I don't see how they're going to slow down. But, I'll be back. I'll be back. We're going to keep doing this. We're going to keep hammering these away. I'll release them when I can. And then at the end of the year, we'll pick it back up. All right, guys, thanks a lot for joining me. Bye.